This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. Among many things, Dr. DeMarco is an expert on urban warfare and the topic that we're going to talk about today in a lot of detail, World War II, particularly World War II in Europe. Now, what we want to talk about specifically has to do with when you have armies in contact with each other for an extended period of time, so we're not just going straight to a culminating battle. One of the things you have to do is you have to manage your personnel, and you have to sometimes build or rebuild units on the fly, what's often kind of generically referred to as reconstitution. And I want to start us off with a quote from the FM Field Manual 3.0 Operations from 2025. Some combination of maneuver and attrition is typically necessary to achieve victory during armed conflict. This is reflected in the defeat mechanisms, which encompass both ideas. So, Dr. DeMarco, what is reconstitution, kind of as a concept, and what, you know, what's the basic principle at work there?
Well, when you're talking this subject, you do need to be specific about the words that you use. So, reconstitution means a unit that has been rendered combat ineffective due to casualties, then is filled with replacements and replacement personnel and equipment, and usually goes through a period of retraining, and then is declared fit for combat. It's a deliberate process, not to be confused with replacements. Mm-hmm. Replacements are the more common way that we fill gaps in the line, which is in the American system, historically, has been the individual replacement system.
So let's kind of understand what's happening here, and if I'm understanding these terms correctly. So we have a war like the ETO in World War II, 1944-45. You've got many divisions on a line from the Channel to Switzerland. What it sounds like you're saying is replacement is where you keep the division in line and you feed it new men, right. Whereas reconstitution, you're pulling the division out of the line. Is that correct?
Yes, and you know, typically, probably not a division would be a division size unit would probably not be reconstituted. But yeah, that's exactly it. You pull it out. In some armies, that is the standard way that the German army, for example, fought their units down to they were combat ineffective. You know, somewhere's between 20% and 30% strength, and never received replacements, and then the whole unit is pulled out of the line for months, usually, mm-hmm. and completely rebuilt, retrained, mm-hmm. with some veterans, but a lot of new people, and then put back into combat. That was not the standard procedure in the U.S. Army. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Okay, so before we get into the details, I want one more definitional term. So oftentimes we hear consolidation and reorganization, kind of almost in the same breath as reconstitution, but they're different processes. Can you talk about about how they're different?
Okay, so consolidation and reorganization, generally, you know, that can be a deliberate process or a hasty process. Hasty process is you finish with the mission and you consolidate where you're at and reorganize, resupply, redistribute ammunition, maybe bring in replacements, evacuate wounded, maybe rest in place, although you're not necessarily out of combat, you're not executing an active mission other than maybe a defense or an assembly area, but you're and that's a very short process before you're ready to execute missions again. Whereas reconstitution is a very deliberate, time-consuming, resource-intensive process where you're pulled out of the line, and it's not a quick fix to get you ready for combat again. We rebuild this unit, with the exception of the veteran personnel, essentially from nothing.
Mm-hmm. So for consolidation reorganization is, I'm on the objective where I had two squads, now I've got one, so I'm just going to put the soldiers together, highest ranking guys, now the squad leader, we're going to go off and fight. Whereas reconstitution is, I've lost a platoon entirely, so I've got 30 replacements and a lieutenant, they're going to show up into the company at some later date.
Yeah, like I said, one is consolidation and reorganization is a hasty process done in contact or just outside of contact. And it may be that you consolidate the platoon, but it may be as simple as, okay, the corporal is now the sergeant because the sergeant's been medevaced. We resupply with ammo or we redistribute ammo so it can be as quickly as, how many magazines do you have? Well, give half your magazines to this guy who has none. Or it can be first sergeant drives up in a vehicle and everybody go load their empty magazines or get a quick meal and then be ready to go again. So it's reorganization and consolidation is a very quick process designed to get the unit ready for to continue in combat.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so when we often talk about building an army, and particularly in World War II, you got a drafty army with large numbers of folks coming in, we often talk about filling up divisions. So 36th Infantry Division, 4th Infantry Division, whatever, 1st Armored Division, and those are filled by a table of organization of equipment and people, right? So we know we need so many people in the right rank, the right specialty, et cetera. But where are the people coming for the replacements? In other words, we've got the people for the division, but then how do we feed that division once it's built with people?
Well, that's a process that in World War II, we built the divisions as organizations back in the States and then deployed them at 100, maybe slightly over 100% strength. And then, even before they get into combat, attrition begins. But once they get into combat, there's a steady attrition. And so that's fed by a personnel pipeline that extends all the way back to the draft allocation, so to the highest strategic level where the Army puts in its dibs for how many of the draft in a particular month that it wants, competing with all the other services.
Right, and we're remembering, too, that the Air Force is part of the Army in this war. So for the listeners to understand, when the Army puts in allocations, it's the Army Air Force as well.
That's true, although there's a very bright line between who's going to be, how many of any particular draft go to the Army Air Force, and then the rest gets dumped into the General Army pile, and then the Army Air Force, although it's part of the Army, has its own staff and its own personnel section. Mm-hmm. And so they argue with, G1 of the Army versus G1 of the Army Air Force, arguing about how much of a piece of the Army pie they should get. Really, the Air Force in World War II, Army Air Corps, treated as a separate service for all practical purposes. Mm-hmm. So, if there's a dispute, it goes right up to Marshall and Hap Arnold or their respective G1s. The Air Force is probably still calling their guys G1s at this point. Nowadays they're called the A1, you know, they can't be like the Army, so they have an A staff. But the point is that that's all decided at the strategic level, but the reality is that decision then, as it filters down months later when those personnel are finished training, that determines how many replacements you have, individual replacements you have to fill out.
So let's take that a step further. So we said people, right? Or we've got mass O people that are going to the Army Ground Forces as distinguished from that other part. Right. So let's just keep our numbers simple because I'm bad at math. We've got 1,000 people that are going to the Army Ground Forces in this month. How do we know what to do with them? In other words, are they infantrymen? Are they artillerymen? Are they radio operators? How do we kind of figure all that piece out?
Well, the table of organization is your first guide. You know that across the Army, by the various, you know, how many divisions you have, how many corps headquarters, because every organization from a truck company in the COMZ, the communication zone, you know, way in the rear, has a TOE. So the Army knows at its end strength by MOS, by military occupational specialty, they know exactly how many they should have. That's the response, you know, that's, you know, on paper. Then the G1 plans people, that's the personnel plans people, get with the G3, the operations plans people, and they look at the world, if you're on the Army staff. And the G3 has consolidated what the upcoming months in advance plans are of the various theaters. So the Pacific Theater says, this is what we're planning to do. And based on those plans, the theaters have estimated the resources that they will need to execute it, including in that our casualty numbers. G1, so the personnel person in the theater has a plan shop and an operation shop, and they work closely with their G3, what are our plans and operations, and they project out in the G1 plans, this is how many casualties we're going to take, and they break that down by MOS. And at beginning of World War II, it's a guess. Because, you know, other than World War I, we have no basis of knowledge. Right. By the end of the war, you know, by 1945 for sure, but even in 44, the Italian campaign, and there has been fighting in the Pacific, and so they have an idea what they might lose. But it's still a guess, a total guess. And but they do know within that guess. So they, you know, the guess is a raw number, but that's not good enough. The raw number is then broken down, again, by a conversation in the between the G1 and the G3 at the theater level. And this is based on conversations and coordination with all the subordinate commands, usually to division level. Below division level, you don't have that kind of long-range planning. And really, divisions will plan for the next operation, corps will plan for two operations ahead, and the theater is looking at the campaign plan, which could be over a year to 18 months. And they will look at, you know, how many by, this is the total, and then they will break it down and go, and we think we're going to need this many infantrymen. And they know that because of the nature of the organization and the type of fighting that they're going to do, that the casualties are going to be disproportionate in the combat MOSs, particularly the medics and the infantrymen, and then probably in rank order, the armor crewmen and artillerymen, and the obviously truck drivers are not going to be as impacted by combat operations as your infantrymen. So they break it down. All of that goes up to Army. So the Pacific Theater will say, over the next year, we think we're going to need X number of infantrymen. And the European theater says, we think we're going to need X number of infantrymen as individual replacements. This is over and above what's already out there in the TOE. And then Big Army sits down and goes, well, we don't have that many. So who's the priority? Okay, Europe is the priority, Pacific is not. So Europe, you're going to get 80% of what you ask for, and the Pacific theater, you're going to get 50% of what you ask for. And then that gets, you know, that's all in the planning stage. Nobody has taken any casualties yet. And then internal to Big Army, you know, that number and by MOS is filtered down to the requisition system. So as draftees are coming in, you know, the draft boards know how many they need to draft and how many of those then are going to be infantrymen and how many of them are going to be radio operators and whatever, anticipating losses at some point in the future that are largely guesstimated, but based on operational plans, and then as the war goes on, prior experience, mm-hmm. And prioritization of the various operations and theaters. So, you know, the Italian front is not going to get very many. Northwest Europe is going to get more than everybody else proportionally. Mm-hmm. And then those same priorities exist in the theater when, you know, the training base kicks out months later, mm-hmm. A trained infantryman who gets on a, you know, who goes in World War II as an individual replacement, is deployed and eventually ends up in a replacement battalion. And that's broken down, so he'll arrive in theater and there'll be a adjutant general corps replacement organization that receives him off the boat, checks his MOS, checks his name off, and sends him then on some transportation mode into the theater and turns him over to the G1 of, let's say, First Army. First Army has a replacement battalion. They process them. They look at the corps. They'll forward them to a replacement company that each corps has in the rear, might be a replacement battalion. They'll check his MOS. They'll see what's going on within their corps as far as divisions are concerned, and they'll forward, break those guys down by MOS and sometimes by grade, but in World War II, pretty much everybody came in as a private. Mm-hmm. So you got a huge number of privates. Where you would get an NCO most commonly in World War II is somebody who was wounded and returned, because you got the raw replacements coming from the States, but you'd be surprised at how many wounded and returned to duty guys are. You're wounded and evacuated to within the corps to the corps level. Then 2 weeks later, it was a minor wound, he's back out. He'll probably go right back to his original unit if it's within the corps. If he's evacuated to the theater level, then he becomes a theater asset and he goes to the replacement battalion, and most likely he won't go back to his unit because he's now, you know, in the he's mixed in with the stream of replacements coming from the States. Mm-hmm. But he might be at that point a sergeant or a staff sergeant, and but at least my research is very rare that you get an NCO coming from the States. Mm-hmm. Almost all the NCOs that show up are guys who are returned to duty from wounded in the theater and then returned to duty. And then those guys are often, they jump that whole system because they're like, screw this, I'm going back to my unit, right, where I started from. And so you have guys showing back up in units 3 months after they were wounded, having spent 3 months in a hospital in England, and they follow the normal system until they get to like the theater, and then they just walk out of the replacement battalion, jump on, find a truck that's heading towards where they think their unit is, and eventually show up at their company and say, I'm back. And
you see this famously in the Band of Brothers show,
and that's not untypical. More typical though is that these guys never get beyond the core level, and so it's easy to get back to their unit.
They're still kind of in-house, if you will.
Yeah. But, you know, the Army was, the U.S. Army in World War II, especially, is an amateur army, with not a whole lot of people who understand what they're doing. And the further back into the bureaucracy of the system you go, the less people who understand what they're supposed to be doing. And so, you know, if a guy just doesn't show up, you know, who's on a list, there's not a whole lot. No, the care factor is pretty low. Desertion is treated seriously. But if people are trying to get back to their unit, you know, most people are shrugging and fine with that. And, you know, first sergeant, when the guy shows up, will go, well, you're not on my list, but I'll add you on, and they'll paper drill it, and it'll go back up. Eventually, the paper gets straightened out.
Especially if they're an experienced soldier, right? I imagine you wouldn't want to turn them down.
Well, these guys, you know, they're going back to the unit. They know people there, and people know them. And, as I said, it was an amateur army, but in a lot of ways, because of that, you don't have professional bureaucrats.
Right.
So nobody really cares as long as the mission is getting done. The new recruits don't know any better than to follow the pipeline all the way to wherever they get dumped. But the guys who've been around it, you know, long enough to get wounded have seen and heard from their peers who've been wounded and returned how the system works. And generally, at least, you know, the accounts that I've read of experienced infantrymen is if they could get back to their original unit, then they did. Even guys who didn't like the original unit would rather be back with people they know than with a bunch of strangers.
Right. So you talk about this pipeline that reaches all the way from the front to the local draft boards back in the United States. What kind of time offset are we talking about? So you mentioned these guesses and allocations and projections. When theater sends back, okay, we need 100,000 infantrymen, when will they see those men?
Not anytime soon. and the reason for that is if everything works perfectly, you're talking probably from the time they say they be in, let's say the theater says, we think we're going to need 20% infantry replacements in for the Normandy landings. So that projection is made 6 months before the landing so that those guys will get there 6 months from now.
So, and that's the process from draft to functional infantryman, that 6 months?
Roughly. You know, it depends on how desperate they are for replacements. It depends on, you know, that nothing changes between the time they make the projection. It depends on what they're being trained to do. If we're training a guy to be a radio man, it's going to take a lot longer.
Right.
Same with medics, because they will receive very specialized training.
Which is not also something you can rush.
No. Radio men in World War II had to be proficient at keying Morse code. It takes a long time to train that.
Right, especially under stress, I would imagine.
Yeah, and they had to pass certain tests, and if you didn't pass a test, you got recycled. If you didn't pass it again, you got sent to the infantry pool or someplace, you know, that was less challenging. Infantrymen, on the other hand, probably, and I don't really know the
identify a rifle 2 out of 3 times, you're good.
Well, go to the range, got to learn how to march and take care of your equipment, but essentially basic training was good enough.
Great story from my grandfather. So he qualified early as a marksman, and he said at a certain point they'd have people they knew wouldn't qualify, so they would just use a pencil to mark it for them.
Could be. My father-in-law was an infantryman in World War II. He volunteered after Pearl Harbor. He was turned down for having flat feet in 1941. In 1943, he was drafted as an infantryman.
Yeah.
So, you know, standards change based on the needs and the anticipated casualties. Mm-hmm. So the standards for infantry were very high mm-hmm. in 1941, and by 1943 they had been lowered significantly. Mm-hmm. Famously, and that applied to all MOSs, famously Jimmy Stewart, who had just won an Academy Award for the movie The Philadelphia Story, I think so, yeah. 1940,
yeah.
Volunteered in 1940, before the war started, and was turned down because he was too skinny, mm-hmm. didn't weigh enough. Mm-hmm. And then he was drafted after Pearl Harbor because they lowered the standards.
Right, right.
And so, how long you're in the pipeline could depend on, you know, a whole bunch of factors. But I would say for, until you got to combat, probably 3 or 4 months at least, more probably average 6 months. And some guys, you know, would get, you just finished basic training, but we need cooks here at the training base, and we don't have any school-trained cooks, so you're going to stay for a couple months and be a cook for a while before we send you back in the infantry pipeline. Mm-hmm. So everybody's experience would be very different.
So both of you are veterans. Both of you have commanded soldiers. I'm going to ask you both a dumb question that I'm sure a lot of people have. The Soviets do this very quickly in World War II because they need bodies at the front. Having commanded soldiers... Question for both of you. Why don't we do it like that? Why don't we take the draftee, hand him a rifle, and in 2 weeks he's going to be at the front?
The problem comes into is just there's a training and a competency aspect. I mean, you can train him which end of the rifle the bullet comes out of and which one it goes into and all that kind of stuff. But in terms of actually staying alive, there's other things that you have to do, and ideally you train them with the people they're going to be working with. Ideally, the U.S. system doesn't do this very well either in World War II. But the problem is that if you just shove a dude with a rifle into a uniform and out the door, the odds of you having to replace that guy within the next week are pretty high. Mm-hmm. So there's some effort to get some return on investment by keeping the guy alive through some modicum of training.
Well, there's a difference between, it starts at the strategic level. How are you going to use your soldiers? Soviet doctrine is very coarse, and the expectation of the soldier is he knows how to pull the trigger and load his rifle. Not really concerned about, does he know first aid? Does he actually know how to use the bayonet? And do a butt stroke with his rifle, because there are techniques to doing that. Mm-hmm. Does he know how to throw a grenade? What other skills might he need? How do you build a foxhole? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a trained skill. There are certain ways to do it where you survive. It's not just digging a hole, and so all armies make a determination, what are the basic skills that you're going to need. Now, and it starts at the highest level, where the Soviet Army makes the assumption that our guys don't need to know anything other than, how to pull the trigger. Things like surviving in the wilderness, the Soviet attitude is either he's off the farm and he probably knows how to do that anyway, or... he'll figure it out, or he won't. He'll, freeze to death or catch a disease because he doesn't know basic hygiene, and we'll just suck that loss up because we got gazillions of these guys.
Yeah, there's 10 more behind him.
Right. And so they're not concerned about individual training. The U.S. Army, first off, especially in 1940, in order for the Army to function the way... the U.S. Army wants itself to function, people got to be able to read and write. Mm-hmm. And so first, one of the basic things was, can you read or write?
And I think it's important for people to understand, people coming in as either volunteers or draftees in America, they may have a 4th to 6th grade education. This is not universal, K-12 education yet.
Right. It was a different society. Same with hygiene. Mm-hmm. Some people, coming in the Army, some recruits don't have, you know, first time they've seen a toothbrush mm-hmm. was basic training. Mm-hmm. But the Army understands that to keep track of all of their equipment, people need to sign receipts. And so even if you can't write your name, we're going to teach you enough so that you can put a mark down there that we can call your name in order to track the equipment. Russian Army didn't care about tracking the equipment. We want our soldiers to be able to take care of themselves and their buddies if they're wounded. So there's going to be, you know, several days of first aid training mm-hmm. To avoid things like trench foot and just normal illnesses. Mm-hmm. We're going to teach basic hygiene. Because
scabies is a big one, yeah.
Yeah, basic hygiene, washing and shaving. And we're going to, and so those, and we're not only going to show them how to do it. You know, I can tell you first time I was required to shave more than one day in a row was, you know, when I went to basic training. Mm-hmm. And that was a new thing. I mean, I was 18. I could get away with shaving, you know, once or twice a week. Not by the Army standards, you shave every day. And the training period builds that establishes that standard and hopefully also establishes it as a routine so that when he arrives in the unit, they don't have to worry about teaching you how to shave. They can focus on war fighting.
And maintaining items. Like, here's a booklet that tells you how, in third and fourth grade written language, how to maintain your X.
How to keep a machine gun firing.
Rifle, yeah. Machine gun, Jeep, how to pack your rock. All of these things, and these manuals, which still exist, are great to read because it's like, so you're a soldier now. Mm-hmm. These are the things you need to know.
See GI Run.
And so, you know, so we have this training period so that when the soldier arrives in the unit, the unit doesn't have to train him. Mm-hmm. They focus on employing him. He's ready to go. He knows how to take care of himself, how to take care of his equipment. He knows what the standards are, mm-hmm. And all the unit has to do is integrate him into the machine. In the Soviet Army, that learning curve continues and never actually reaches the level where where a U.S. soldier coming out of basic training does all the things we just talked about. A Soviet soldier would not be expected, even after a couple years of service, to know basic hygiene or first aid. Mm-hmm. And casualties accrue, but again, because of their manpower situation, they didn't really care. It was easier to replace a soldier than train a soldier.
So we've been talking a lot about soldiers, and of course that's the bulk of the manpower. Let's at least touch on the same issue with officers. So how does this work for officers coming in as replacements? And again, the Band of Brothers example, this is when I think his name is Colin Hanks shows up as a replacement officer. So how does that work?
Similar, but the level of training is higher. Officers, generally, even in World War II, the expectation was you had some level of college education. Mm-hmm. And there were exceptions to that. I think before the war, there were programs like, I think, the Air Cadet program where, if you had flying experience, then we weren't that concerned about whether you actually went to college or not. And you didn't have to have an associate degree. Any amount of college might qualify. And, of course, part of the induction process, everybody came in as a private. Mm-hmm. So, like, Jimmy Stewart, who ended up as lieutenant colonel, was drafted as a private. And then in the induction process, you go through a series of tests and where first they ask you, did you go to college? But if you didn't go to college, you take a standards battery of tests which measure your intelligence and aptitude for a variety of things. And then they also look at your experience. So you could be, let's say, you were a police sergeant. but you didn't go to college. That might qualify you to be a lieutenant in the MPs.
Kind of an experiential education. Yeah.
Yeah. So you, because you had leadership experience, supervisory experience.
And it's almost a one-to-one job, right? I mean, it kind of makes sense that you might.
Yeah. I mean, you know, not perfect, but especially in World War II, where the draft was so massive that if you were, let's say, a teamster, but you were a foreman who managed assistant manager in a trucking company, you might come in as a quartermaster truck officer,
As opposed to infantry, which is the
right.
the major. You can't train that in civilian life.
Right, but if you had college education but no particular skills, you're a English literature major. Sounds like an infantry officer to me. And so if you have non academic credentials that were significant, that would be noted in the induction process. Because back to my Jimmy Stewart example, he was a multi-engine qualified commercial pilot, owned his own airplane. And so, you know, that counted for a lot. He also went to college for 4 years.
Right.
But there were a lot of people with those type of particular expertise that that was not, because a very small percentage of Americans went to college
in
those days.
Yeah, I think it's still like 4% or so. It's
It's small. It was rising quickly. So there were a lot of people in the 40s who had a little bit of college.
Right.
And that qualified you for going to be commissioned. And then you would still go to officer school in addition to regular training, a generic OCS type commissioning school that would take, even today, that only takes 90 days.
Okay, so, but we're still talking about a much longer process for officer replacements.
I wouldn't say much longer. I would say add 90 days.
Okay.
Because you would go through, you know, learn your basic infantry skills and basic training, and then you, once you learn them, then you were determined to be officer material for whatever reason. You would go to OCS, generic officer school, and maybe some specialty school, but for an infantry officer, the only basic skills you needed to know were probably mostly taught to you while you were either in the officer training system or when you were first trained as a basic infantryman.
Now, so, we're talking about second lieutenants there briefly. So
yeah.
So second lieutenant. So the question is, how do we get captains and majors then?
Yeah. Well, everybody in World War II who was a major and below, for sure. Well, I won't say everybody, but most of the majors and below were not in the Army in 1941.
Mm-hmm.
If you were a second lieutenant, regular Army in 1941, you were a major or lieutenant colonel by the end of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And that extended back to, so for example, I had a friend of mine who was a West Point class of 38. So he had been in the Army 3 years when the war started. He was a first lieutenant, had just made first lieutenant. He was lieutenant colonel by the end of the war.
Yeah.
Abrams, who was a full colonel by the end of the war, was West Point class of 34. He had 7 years in the Army and was a captain when the war started and was a full colonel. Gavin was 32 years old and been in the Army 10 years and was a general by the end of the war. Of course, you know, that applied to all ranks. Eisenhower in 1940 was a lieutenant colonel, was a five-star general 5 years later. So everybody who had any experience got promoted very quickly.
So let's talk about the tip of the spear, kind of the replacement process in practice. You mentioned that you would, you know, you'd go through all these bureaucratic levels, you'd end up at some, you know, battalion company close to the front, and then you go to the front, you go to your unit. If you're, say, a radio operator, do you show up with your radio, or do you fall in on the equipment in the division?
You can answer this too, right? It's the same way we do things today. Everybody gets a standard kit, and then based on your MOS, you get a standard kit of special stuff. So like a standard kit would, you know, generally speaking, it depends on your MOS, but everybody would deploy with a standard kit of stuff, and then either most likely in theater when they said, oh, you're going to be an infantryman, infantrymen might get a couple of extra pieces of equipment, but not much extra, because everybody is considered kind of a combat soldier, so you get the same stuff. Special MOSs like tankers would get some special pieces of equipment, like a tanker's helmet, but that, even in World War II, I think the tanker's helmet was part of the tank, not an individual's
piece. Like with the radio. The radio is a piece of unit equipment. So there's individual equipment, and then there's organizational equipment.
So the reason I'm asking this is we used to have a great lesson about the battle around St. Vith in 1944. Right before that battle, remind me, there's a unit there, the division that's been experienced.
2nd Infantry Division.
2nd Infantry Division. They have a bunch of captured equipment. They've picked it up along the way from Normandy to the front. They are relieved right before the German offensive by a new
The 106th Infantry.
The 106th, which is coming with stock equipment. So how does that process work where the unit is kind of vacuuming up, you know, like captured German stuff?
Well, in World War II, remember I said at the beginning, World War II was an amateur army, and keeping track of equipment was very loose. And it was not, the advantage of that was they were not very bureaucratic. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, if you needed, once you got into the theater and you were in a unit, and now, especially after you'd been exposed to combat, people were like, you know, the number of professionals is very tiny. But even the professionals understood that in combat, the peacetime rules don't apply. And so, you know, for example, cavalrymen, mechanized cavalrymen, were all issued carbines. That was what the TOE said they would be issued.
And for all the Texas boy, and then for the shooter, the M1 carbine is a 30 caliber. It's basically a very underpowered rifle cartridge or a very overpowered pistol cartridge, however you want to take a look at it. It's a wonderful target shooting rifle. It's a great close quarters thing. It's not great for anything about over, what, 300 meters, 200 meters?
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's not very well made. I have one. It's just, I mean, anyway, the point is that these guys would get those, and after they'd been in combat for a month, they'd realize this is a crappy weapon for our mission. And I talked to veterans who said there wasn't a carbine to be found in the unit within a month after they got into combat. Number one, nobody was keeping track of them. And number two, there were plenty of, you know, in the casualty evacuation process, M1 rifles were just stacked around the hospitals or at the casualty evacuation centers. And so they picked, as fast as they could, soldiers got themselves an M1 Garand, because the M1 was an exceptional combat weapon, and the M1 carbine was not. And so that kind of thing happened. You know, and it happened with little equipment, and it happened with big equipment. I have a famous story that I had talking to a cavalryman officer, battalion commander or squadron commander in World War II. He had to turn in his M5 Stuart tanks for the new M24 Chaffee tanks. And they were getting 17 Chaffees for the 17 Stuarts in the tank company. And they didn't dislike the Stuarts. The Stuart was not a great tank. But the M8 armored cars they had in the cavalry troops, they disliked them a lot. And so the squadron commander decided, we're not going to turn in the Stuarts, we're going to turn in the M8 armored cars. And he had his staff officer, his maintenance officer, drive 17 armored cars back to the depot to pick up 17 light tanks. And the guy at the depot said, you know, why are you here? And he said, I'm here to turn in these light tanks for those brand new M24s. And the guy said, are those tanks? And he's like, they are. And the guy was like, whatever, and took the armored cars and gave them 17 tanks. The 17 tanks went to replace the Stuarts and the tank company, and then the old Stuarts were used to replace the armored cars and the cavalry troops, because the M8s were armored cars were terrible cross country, and much although the Stuarts weren't heavily armored compared to an armored car, they were much more heavily armored, and so they, you know, so if you can do that with an entire company of tanks, changing out rifles and machine guns and stuff like that was simple.
So I want to just kind of pull on this one. This is probably a topic for an entirely another podcast, but at least want to touch it because we've been talking about personnel replacement systems and bureaucracy. Can you touch just briefly on how do we get the equipment there? So it's not, and I'm not talking about rifles necessarily, although we could and all that kind of stuff, but just basically how to, we've got the meat part of the equation, to put it very crudely, but how do we get the metal back to that organization to keep it in combat?
You mean like major pieces of equipment, like tanks and
like
stuff?
Tanks, armored personnel, or not armored personnel, but half tracks, jeeps, airplanes.
Well, you know, there's a supply system. The same supply system that, you know, provides you a rifle, provides tanks, provides radios. So you're talking about radios. Not so much a new radio operator shows up. He's replacing an old radio operator. When a person is casualty of act, one of the things that happens at the casualty collection point is they strip off all the useful equipment. So if he's a radio operator and he has a radio, that doesn't get sent back to the rear. That stays, you know, at the casualty collection point, if not earlier. Somebody strips that off of him. Usually that's no later than at the battalion level, and then it gets sent back to the company where it came from.
So this is not, this is not pre-modern warfare where you have your saber and your musket and your hat. This is really industrial warfare where that's the army's rifle.
Yeah, although you do have your saber, your musket, your hat until you get wounded.
Until you die.
And then we're not sending that weapon back to the rear. We'll send your hat and your, but personal equipment also, you know, is consolidated. When you're in a foxhole, you got just what you need to survive in that foxhole. The Army has issued you a whole pile of stuff, and that stuff is in a bag, duffel bag, that is in the rear somewhere, not that far in the rear, but far enough on a truck probably, or and follows you through the war, and that breaks in combat, or when things are slow, they'll rotate soldiers out to get a change of clothes and stuff. But, you know, it amazes me how people cannot, modern day civilians can't imagine going more than a day without a shower. Whereas in World War II, and even in the modern army, when you go to the field, you'll wear the same clothes and go without a shower for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month. Underwear and socks are about the only thing you change. And really, socks are the only thing that you need to change.
Right, because of trench foot.
Yeah, and trench foot and other foot things that have to do with, that aren't as severe, but still debilitating.
Right.
So, you know, socks are the only item of clothing that I think the Army really cares about.
So what you're getting at is that we have a vast bureaucracy to handle taking to keeping a unit topped off with a class of supply called a person.
Yeah.
And also a vast bureaucracy topped with keeping that unit topped off with everything. And this is the part we miss, right? We always talk about tanks and rifles and airplanes, but socks.
Yeah,
there's a factory socks making like, GI socks,
and socks were like I said, the only piece of, I mean, there were some cool pieces of equipment soldiers loved, but the ones the chain of command was most concerned with was socks, and still is. You know, you go to the field as an infantryman today, and your squad leader is responsible for how many. He doesn't care how many T-shirts you have, but he does care. And he's responsible for how many clean pair of socks you have. And keeping those socks dry, number one, and somewhat clean, number two, is a command responsibility.
But it also keeping the socks, like as you tear it up, so you're going to need new ones at some point, right?
And in the line, The amount of soldiers, when you say attrition warfare, in World War II, it was attrition warfare for infantrymen. In a line company, and there's a great book came out about less than a year ago that focuses on the daily events in an infantry company. 3 to 7medical evacuations, I won't say casualty, because some of these are for like the flu. Mm-hmm. Some of them are for trench foot. And some of them are got shot.
Yep.
Although the most common war battle-inflicted casualty is shrapnel wounds from artillery. On a typical day where nothing special is happening, you're going to lose 2 guys, 2 to 5 guys. Some of them are going to be sick. That happens in peacetime, too. Some mm-hmm. of them are going to be sick, and some of them are going to be casualty. As soon as you go into combat, you're going to lose 15 or 20 guys in a 170-man infantry company. If you're in combat for a week, you'll lose a third of the company. But even if you're not in combat for a week, over a week, if you're losing 2 to 5 guys a day, you just lost, 14. So there's a steady trickle of guys going to the rear, and some are just going to battalion to get warm and get over a cold. And some of them are going back to a hospital where they're going to be treated for trench foot, and in 2 weeks or so they'll be back. Or some of them have pneumonia and they're there. Or they have a fragmentation wound from artillery. It's going to be stitched up. It's going to be, they'll give him a week to recover, and then he's back to the unit. And some of them are more seriously wounded and they're gone forever. But there's this steady trickle of guys out and a steady trickle of guys in. And so your typical, in the case of this most recent deep dive book that I'm referencing, B Company, 39th Infantry, 9th Infantry Division. Over the course, they go into combat in North Africa. They end, they land on like D plus one, and they fight all through the Northwest. They were in Sicily and then all through the Northwest European campaign. They go through 400% of the company in 3 years from this trickle of events. By the time they get to 1945, out of 170 guys, you have less than 30 that mm-hmm. were in the company at the beginning of the 3 years earlier. Yeah. And so this individual replacement program is a steady, small on a daily or even weekly basis, but steady flow of veterans out and then replacements in, and then within a few months, they're veterans. And then as you go through the rosters in these infantry companies, you'll see Sergeant Smith medevaced for the third time. So 2 or 3 minor wounds each time he's gone for a few weeks and then comes back to the company. And so over the course of the war, in terms of combat casualties, a veteran infantry company suffers more than 100% casualties. Mm-hmm. Everybody who was four out of five officers in an infantry company, pretty much all the officers are either killed, wounded, or promoted because they survived.
Right.
And they're not there, 8 or 9 months later.
Yeah. And that's an interesting point. We don't think of a promotion as a casualty, but to the lower unit, they lose that skill and they go somewhere else. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So we've talked about this kind of from the individual replacement level. Let's return to the kind of the higher level when we're talking about reconstitution at the very beginning. So let's say one of these units gets in a fight that is heavily casualty causing. So instead of having the trickle, as you said, the 2 to 5 a day, in a given week, that company may lose, 60 in a heavy fight. How do we handle that kind of shock where it's not a trickle?
A couple different ways. One, what you might do is you might consolidate them with another organization and stand up an entirely new company. What you're also going to do is that at that point, like the 14th Cavalry Group is a great example. They're the cavalry group that's in the Lillesheim Gap in the Ardennes that they take it on the chin. They lose half their vehicles, a third of the total group is basically gone, killed, wounded, or captured. And what they do is they just bring in, they're pulled off the line for about a month to be rebuilt with those replacements. Now, the problem is that if you give them a higher percentage of replacements, there's only so many people, if that makes sense. And so what that means is that other cavalry organizations are not getting, today we call them 19 Deltas, I don't even know what they, if they had a number there, but cavalry, other cavalry organizations are not getting those. What they're also doing by this point in the war is they're stripping out non-needed occupational specialties. You're not really worried about the Luftwaffe in January of 1945, so
your air defenders become what you need.
Yeah, and that's the other source of readily available manpower a lot of the time.
Yeah, and of course, Northwest Europe in 1945, or really actually beginning by September of 44, is experiencing an infantry shortage,
right.
Massive, and it gets worse and worse and worse, and it culminates just before the Battle of the Bulge, where across the theater, so we're talking 9th Army, 1st Army, 3rd Army, infantry companies are filled at about 60%, 60 to 70%, really more like 60%.
For context, if either one of you in your career walked into a company fresh as a new officer in that company and you saw it was at 60%, what would happen in your mind?
Well, you probably say this company can't do its mission.
Okay.
The numbers are deceiving, though, because we'll say, not so much at company level, but at battalion level, they might say, oh, the battalion's at 80, 85% strength. That sounds reasonable, okay? We function all the time in peacetime with battalions at 80% strength. But when you dig down in combat, the headquarters company's at 100% strength, and the weapons company, which doesn't take as many casualties, is maybe at 80% strength. And the rifle companies are at 65%, but the rifle platoons in the company are at 55% strength.
Mm-hmm. And the only saving grace at this particular stage in the game is there's this wonderful term the Army started to reuse, which is relative combat power, which is our rifle companies are at 60% strength, but so are the Germans.
Right.
And that is some of a saving grace.
How close are you to the bottom of the barrel? Yeah.
So the point is that they are recognizing, they start recognizing as early as September, mm-hmm. that the infantry, I talked before about the planning process. Well, despite the great success of the breakout from Normandy and the low casualties that are produced by that, the infantry casualties are still much higher than the planners anticipated, both in the before the breakout and then especially as they start to come up against the Siegfried line in late September, October. Infantry casualties are going up steadily. And the replacement stream, which was started months previously, didn't anticipate that, mm-hmm. And so they start running out of infantrymen, and then it was like, well, where are we going to get these guys? Well, the doctrinal by the book answer is you go all the way back to the draft boards and the classification of the draftees. Prior to the fall of 1944, the absolute best qualified of the draftees were reserved for the Army Air Corps. The Army Air Corps is not suffering anywhere near the casualties in 1944 that they thought, and has probably reached its optimum size, so they don't really need those guys anymore.
Now, ask them in 1943; it would have been a different answer.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And so they start, at the induction centers, guys who would have qualified for the Army Air Corps are now classified as infantrymen. Hmm. But that's going to take 3 or 4 months,
right.
At best.
And it doesn't help that battalion we just pulled out of the
right.
line because it's
exactly.
at 40%.
And so, they start looking for where can we get infantrymen. And one of the solutions is the units that we don't really need as much of, like air defense. Another solution, which is not well studied by historians, is we start desegregating the Army in theater. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have African-American combat units. In Italy, there's an entire African-American division. There's at least two tank battalions that are African-American, but they are segregated mm-hmm. units. We start going to in December of 44, going to segregated quartermaster and air defense and artillery units and saying, we're looking for volunteers for the infantry. Mm-hmm. And by 1945, there are significant numbers of African Americans in, you know, what were white all, and I say white, it's not really white, mm-hmm. because the only people who are segregated are really African Americans. In the infantry, you'll find Korean Americans, you'll find Chinese Americans, you'll find all
Hispanics of all flavors.
All Hispanics of all flavors, as well as Europeans of all flavors, and many of them not American citizens, but they didn't care. Right. They were, you know, legal residents of the United States and drafted. Mm-hmm. But the point to go back to is, so we start integrating units as another solution to the infantry shortage. But we are in a crisis, infantry crisis, right through the Battle of the Bulge. And it only starts to get relieved by January and February. By then, though, we've now broken through the German defenses. Right. And so what you see is in the last couple of months of the war is lots of replacements, because they started to energize the system back in August and September, and then by January and February, those guys are showing up and the infantry crisis is over.
So I have a kind of a dumb question for my period, which is the Napoleonic period. One of the things Napoleon liked to do as a method both of creating new units, but especially for reconstitution, is he would pull divisions from existing corps, or maybe they had just arrived from France, and he would hand them to a marshal and say, here's three divisions, congratulations, this is your new corps, and then go fight. Why did we not do something like that? So if you have a battalion from each division in a corps or army that's reconstituting, why would you not consolidate them into a division and have that be a new division?
I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what you mean, but I think what you're saying is, why wouldn't we consolidate battalions to create divisions?
Create new units from scratch rather than taking these, you know, reconstituted units and plugging them back into existing divisions.
This is the problem you see, actually. For those that are familiar with the movie Gettysburg, where you have the 20th Maine, and the Union Army during the Civil War would keep veteran units and would not do replacements. What they would do is they would just raise whole new units. It's kind of like what you're talking about there.
Right.
The problem is that a new so what you had is that you had regiments of 1,000 soldiers, brigaded with a regiment of 200 soldiers, mm-hmm. and that regiment of 200 soldiers was a very capable regiment. But it was 80% less than the rookies, and so the problem that you ran into is that also when you raise a new regiment, it's not just the privates, it's the sergeants, it's the majors, and all that kind of stuff as you come through all these pieces. Now, I think I'm kind of hitting where you're coming from in that perspective, but the idea is that we'd rather keep the flags that we have up to strength. Mm-hmm. Rather than to create new flags and let the old flags kind of basically just die off, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and there's a couple unique things about World War II that you didn't see in subsequent wars. One was there was no rotation system, or there was officially a rotation system, but so few people qualified for it that it had virtually no impact on units. Essentially, if you landed with the 39th Infantry Division in North Africa, you were going to be killed or wounded or promoted out of the 39th Infantry Division before you were eligible to rotate. How many times you were wounded and how many action combat actions you were in and when you first deployed all went into that rotation. So a veteran unit that like the 39th regiment that, you know, fighting in North Africa, Sicily, and then in Europe, in Northwestern Europe, they actually had people who by the fall of 44 had reached the criteria to rotate out. Very few, because most of those guys were killed, wounded, or promoted out. But a unit that landed in Normandy, nobody met that criteria before the war ended. And so we ran this individual, you know, it was an individual replacement system, but everybody else in the unit, when you showed up as a newbie, everybody else was a veteran.
Yeah.
And so you integrated into a veteran unit. We thought that was a pretty good system. And, you know, although we had an infantry shortage, we were able to keep our divisions in contact continuously. You know, a unit like the 9th Infantry Division or the 2nd Infantry Division, our veteran units that landed on D-Day or soon thereafter, they were in continuous combat with a couple of breaks, and a break would typically be a week or two pulled out of the line, and not officially reconstituting, but in reserve. And in reserve, they would be maybe out of artillery range, but available to move to the front if needed because they're in reserve, and they would get clean clothes and showers and sleep under a roof. And
new socks,
and some training and new equipment. And the advantage of that was veterans knew would benefit from that. And a short war story is in one of these situations, a veteran infantry company, I want to say late November, early December 44, gets issued wool overcoats. Like 100 infantry companies, 170 guys, 170 brand new wool overcoats come in. Within 48 hours, there are 150 brand new wool overcoats piled up in the snow and mud because the veterans are like, these things are worthless. We don't want them. We don't need them. And the 20 that haven't been thrown away and discarded are the newbies, because they don't know any better. No. They haven't been in foxholes for weeks at an end and realized that this 25-pound overcoat, as soon as it gets wet, weighs 50 pounds and doesn't keep you warm. And so good, you know, veteran. And so we liked having these units where, the vast majority of people were veterans, some of them with years of combat experience and some of them with just a few weeks, but all veterans of a certain length.
All right, so Dr. DeMarco, this has been a great discussion on the replacement and reconstitution process in World War II. What do you think the modern warfighter looking at future multi-domain operations should take away from this?
You got to have a good replacement system. You are going to take casualties. If you're talking about large-scale combat operations against a peer competitor, you're going to take massive amounts of casualties. Very quickly, your professional army is going to be whittled down to a core of veterans who survived the first battle. And you have to have a system of a pipeline that gets individual replacements to the front as quickly as possible. But you also need to understand that that in a LSCO war, the first units in contact are probably going to, a good percentage of them, if not all of them, are going to be lost forever. That's what happens to small professional armies who suddenly are thrown into large-scale combat operations. You know, probably one of the greatest concentrations of our professional army at the beginning of World War II was in the Philippines. And all of that professional expertise is lost with the fall of Bataan and Corregidor. And so, there are you know, the and then the biggest next chunk of our professional army deploys with Second Corps to North Africa, right. And a huge chunk of them are lost at Kasserine Pass, and you know, the cream of the American Armored Corps, the 1st Armored Division, is committed in Kasserine Pass and associated battles, and a huge chunk of them are lost. And so you just, you know, you have to understand that replacements, first the National Guard and then the civilian replacements, are going to be what you're going to fight a war with. And so you have to have a system for integrating those guys, training those guys, and getting them out to the field.
All right. Dr. DeMarco, this has been a great discussion. Thank you.
Yeah. My pleasure.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.